Well, folks, I'm excited to have you here for another episode of the Noble Man Podcast, and I'm with a friend, Drew Hamm. Dr. Drew Hamm is a professor of discipleship at Southeastern Seminary. He's also the vice president of student affairs, I think. He may clarify that. But I have gotten to know him as another guy who is passionate about men's discipleship, and so I'm just so thankful to get to work with him as we invest in students to help them understand biblical manhood for themselves, but also to be prepared as God calls them to some place in ministry to invest strategically in men. And so we're having a great time doing some discipleship activities with young guys in Wake Forest. And so welcome to the show, Dr. Hamm. I am thankful that you're here.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. Super fun.
It is a good time. We enjoy chopping it up with these students. And so last Monday night, we were at, it was Monday night before last, I guess. We were at a table with some guys. We were walking through the book Point Man. And the question came up, is the journey to manhood or is becoming a man a journey, a process? So is it a process that takes time, or is it an event that happens all at once? And so let's talk about that as guys who are passionate about this content, but also fathers together of five sons, and we've had to figure some of this out ourselves. So you've got an 18-year-old son that's in the midst of this right now.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you and he dialoguing about when this young male mm-hmm. becomes a man?
Yeah, great question. I appreciate the question, Mike. But part of what we're all wrestling with, all males, we're born male, but what does it mean to be a man? Not a boy.
Yeah.
When do I become a man? And so part of the conversation, and for those guys who are my age or older, who have sons my age or older, probably all of you went through this. And I mean, you've got three boys, so I'm fascinated to know how you navigated these conversations in your own home. But as my oldest was approaching his 18th birthday, he's got adulthood, legal adulthood in the back of his head.
Right.
And so he starts using the language of, well, I will be an adult when I turn 18. And it's like, wait a second. Let's call time out right there. While the law may call you an adult, there are certain expectations or rights that you have as an adult.
Right.
You're an adult when you make adult decisions, when you make mature decisions. And so by the same token, you're a man when you make manly decisions.
Right.
When you stop being a boy, you know, one guy says, children live for momentary pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Adults postpone that momentary pleasure for the greater good.
Right.
Okay, so Sterling, my oldest, he has a friend at church who has Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the young man with Downs is 20 years old.
Right.
Well, is he a man because he's turned 18? So I'm going to argue, it was actually you that posed the question last week, is manhood an event or a process or a journey? And yeah, I think it has to be a journey because the young man with Downs, is he capable of making those really difficult decisions?
Right.
And so the day you turn 18 is not the day you become a man.
Yeah.
Because if you're still making terrible decisions, you're still acting like a boy. Does that make sense? And how did you frame that with your kid?
It does. I'll get to that, but it makes me think that there are some 40, 50-year-old guys out there that are still making decisions for momentary pleasure that are functioning more like children than like men. And that is part of the challenge that we face in our society, isn't it?
100%. Okay, so what's super interesting to me, I came across this statistic. I'm trying to figure out the wording exactly. I don't want to misrepresent what this research stated. The number one demographic of video game buyers.
Yeah.
Ages 26 to 41. What?
Yeah, they're not teenagers.
Yeah, we're not talking about middle schoolers.
Right.
We're talking about These should be men.
Yeah. Who should have something other to do with their life
than purchasing video games.
Yeah.
But in the country of Britain, video game, so in order to file for divorce, you have to give a legal reason.
Right.
So in America, we say irreconcilable differences. That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a different conversation. But in Britain, you have to give a reason.
Right.
One of the top reasons for divorce in Britain, video games. And one woman stated, it's a quote from her, "My husband cares more about his video games than he cares about me."
Wow.
What are we doing?
Yeah, this is challenging.
But to your point, and to the point of the conversation, we're not raising men.
That's right.
Culturally, we're enabling
boys
to remain boys.
Right.
They're just in adult bodies.
That's right. Yeah, so they can function biologically as adult human beings who are male, but not necessarily as men as we would define manhood from a biblical perspective. And so we're seeing a deficit there.
100%.
And so I'll get to the answer to the question about my sons, and we deal with this, but I think I want to start by talking about some processes in my own life.
Okay.
And thinking about, okay, when did I feel like I had reached a point of maturity in manhood? Because that's part of my own experience that then casts a shadow on how do I deal with my own sons and how do I give them responsibility and how do I treat them? And, you know, so a couple of things that I think about personal experiences, I remember we weren't a big sports family, but I wanted to play football in high school. I didn't start until I was a sophomore, and I wanted to play because I was curious if I was tough enough to hit and be hit, to take the punishment, to give those licks out and come off the field. It was not some grand sports. That was an opportunity for me to test my manhood by playing football.
Hmm.
And so I remember the impact that had on me in participating in that. I'm an Eagle Scout, and so I remember Boy Scouts. There's a suborder of Boy Scouts called the Order of the Arrow. And I remember they set you apart. They do this tap out ceremony where they drag you down in front of everyone and tap you on the shoulders and make you be silent overnight. And then you have to go through this long ordeal, sleeping out in the woods by yourself and doing all these things. And I remember that there were some events like that that were kind of along the way assuring me that I've got something of what it takes that I feel like to be a man. And I did not have someone helping me with this definition. My dad just didn't know this stuff, so he wasn't able to help me with some of these things the way that I was able to do with my sons. But I just remember thinking there were points, punctuated points, where I began to feel like, okay, I can handle myself. I can take care of myself. You know, another big marker was when I finished college. This is kind of funny. And I started making money for myself. I was teaching high school, and I remember being able to buy my family really substantial gifts. And that sounds kind of crazy. I wasn't married at the time, but I remember how excited I was to be able to contribute something to the family that they wouldn't have bought for themselves, that I could. And so it was practicing being a provider in that moment. Mm-hmm. So I had situations where I had to practice being a provider, practice being a protector, practice not being a procreator yet, but just dealing with those things, there were little markers that although they weren't celebrated necessarily in that way, they were just little points where I was thinking to myself, okay, I'm making this journey and I'm figuring this out and I'm becoming a man. I don't know that I can tell you a place where I said, oh, I'm a man. I remember many places where I felt like I was becoming a man. And so does that resonate with you, or how would you look back at your own experience and think about that?
It does resonate. I want to start with actually an entirely different question.
Yeah.
But I want you to make sure that I come back to answer yours.
Okay.
because I don't really like my answer. Here's what I mean. When I say, and particularly for our audience, I want to give you a couple seconds to think about who's the man. When I say, that's a man's man right there.
Yeah.
Who comes to mind? And so I actually want to give our audience a second to think through that. That's a man's man right there. How are we defining that? And so even very particularly, you mentioned that I teach discipleship. Particularly in my doctoral class, I'm really clear to explain you have to define your terms.
Right.
So let's be really careful with how we define our terms. So let's go back now that our audience has had a couple seconds to think of it. When I say man's man, who comes to mind? Well, for us who are believers, who believe in God and the gospel, our answer should be Jesus Christ.
100%.
He was without sin. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. The scriptures tell us that even he overturned tables. And the scriptures tell us, be angry and do not sin.
Yeah.
And we know that he was without sin. Okay, so if he's the model of manhood, here's a really important caveat for us as men. He was not married.
Right.
He did not have biological children.
Right.
And yet, he was fully man.
Right.
That was a man's man. Okay. Having said that and recognizing that and pursuing that in my own life, I do have to be honest with you, Mike. One of the moments, I'll say it this way, I often use this allegory that men are like pickup trucks.
Mm. I like pickup trucks.
The heavier the load, the straighter they drive.
Okay.
In particular, so if you've ever driven a pickup truck in the mountains on a snowy road, the back end will fishtail. Why?
Because it's too light.
There's no weight in the back,
no
right?
Traction. Yeah.
Okay. So you don't really want to drive an unweighted pickup truck in the snow. But where I lived in Colorado, you would literally put sandbags on the rear wheel wells so that there was weight in the back. And sometimes, I mean, you'd have to put a couple hundred pounds back there just to give the back end some weight. And that's my point. So the heavier the load, the straighter they drive. That's true for pickup trucks. For me as a young man, in a lot of senses, I was directionless.
Yeah.
I knew I was pointed toward heaven. I knew I loved Jesus. But when I got married, all of a sudden, the weight of responsibility became much heavier.
Sure.
The heavier the load. So there's a responsibility. There's a woman who has attached herself to me, and I am responsible for her.
Right.
We can get into the whole conversation about a definition of manhood, but part of manhood, part of my definition of manhood is being responsible.
Absolutely.
All right. So now I'm responsible for a wife.
Right.
Okay. So I've said it this way, and I don't mean to be too long with this answer, but there was a time in our life where I was teaching at a small Christian school, and we're newly married, and my paycheck and our rent was a one-for-one.
Yeah.
And I realized that if for some reason she can't work, we can't eat. And so she was a great helper in that season financially. But if she got pregnant and she was on bed rest, we were up a creek.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, so now I've got a wife and a child? Wow, that load just got a lot heavier.
That's right.
And then I've got two kids and three kids. And man, there better be some purpose. There better be some direction. And I'm going to quote Mike Gundy, the college coach whose video went viral of, I'm 40, I'm a man. And I love that video, but by golly, he knew who he was.
Right.
And so, markers of manhood in my own life, getting married, that's a marker. Being a dad, that's a marker.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know what fascinates me about that, and I'm going to come back to the question about dealing with my sons, is that, our culture wrestles with a lot of these things, but actuaries get this. Now, what is an actuary? An actuary is someone who deals with an awful lot of numbers, and they're the ones who determine how much you pay for your insurance. And for years, when young men, the one thing that they can do, or two things they can do to cause their automobile insurance to go down is get married and have a kid.
Hmm.
And so statistically, those folks know that guys who get married, all of a sudden, the sandbags on the wheel wells of their truck just got heavier, and they're going to have some more traction in their lives. And then when they have a kid, there's another couple of sandbags put there. And it's not weight as in it's horrible. It's weight as in they sense I am responsible now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's so funny that we in our secular ways try to figure some of this out. But at some point, numbers don't lie in terms of
exactly
how that all goes.
Sure.
And so I just love it when secular research and data affirms some biblical truth about what happens in the lives of young men. So you go ahead. Do you have a comment?
No, to speak to your point.
Yeah.
I've owned multiple motorcycles.
Yeah.
Since I got married, I've not ridden a motorcycle.
There you go.
To your point.
Yeah. Things change. I'm all of a sudden responsible.
Yeah. I mean, when I fall off of a motorcycle and break a leg as a single guy, who cares? Now, there's some effect.
Yeah.
But minimal.
Yeah.
If I wreck on a motorcycle as a married father and I can't go to work or I get fired from my job, that has tremendous consequences.
Yeah. And it's powerful. Absolutely. So I imagine some of you guys are thinking through some of these things out there. And I want to circle back because Drew earlier asked me about how have you dealt with this with your sons? And so those of you listening may or may not know that we have three sons and a daughter. Our oldest is Army infantry officer. And then our next is an Army aviator. Then we've got a son that's about to graduate from college and a daughter who's second year in college. But I sought to be very intentional with helping cast vision for what manhood looked like for our sons. And there's a great resource that I'll mention here, Raising a Modern Day Knight, written by Robert Lewis, released probably in 92 or 93, somewhere in there. Our oldest son was born in 95, and my wife gave that book to me shortly after he was born for Father's Day. I'm not even sure how she found out about it, maybe from Focus on the Family or something. But that book gave me a roadmap that I didn't have before that to invest very strategically and intentionally in my sons' lives and to punctuate certain parts of their lives with ceremony and activity and intentional engagement as a dad. And so that was a great resource. But part of what we were working on all the time is to help them understand that manhood, you look to Jesus, you care for people well, you live a selfless life, you invest in others, you take responsibility. So now I'm going to drift into this definition of manhood that we got from Robert Lewis: reject passivity, accept responsibility, lead courageously, and invest eternally. And so that became the mantra that we talked about with our kids all the time. And so what does it mean, Tim? Are you being passive in this moment, or are you accepting responsibility for what you've done or what you need to do? Are you going to lead courageously in this moment, or are you going to drift away from what you know you should do? Are you investing? Are you making decisions that are good now, but down the road are not going to produce the fruit that you want? So I was discipled by Robert Lewis, quite honestly, as a young father through that book, and I know a lot of guys were, and so I would just recommend that to you. But beyond that, as I began to understand what I could invest in my kids, I really wanted to be an engaged, intentional dad, and so some of the goofy things that it may seem goofy, it was inspiring and fun at the time. Like, I would take them out of school and we'd go to Maxwell's leadership workshop, the Chick-fil-A leader cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds kind of goofy, but man, to give my kids a day out of school and to take them and let's listen to some of the most well-known leaders in the world, and then we process that together was rich. And then we'd go out to Chick-fil-A and eat a biscuit on Wednesday morning, and I would usually walk them through some sort of leadership book that we were to our book about manhood. And so I intentionally invested in one-on-one time with them. That was the food was the bait. Guys, if you really want to have an opportunity to invest in your sons, then do it around food. And those moments became rich because I just would ask them, hey, what's going on? And I'll also say to you that guys, having a book, just say, hey, let's go out and have breakfast. it doesn't always work so well because you're face-to-face and what do we say to each other? And so I've always appreciated having something that gave us a catalyst for conversation. So we read chapter one in a book or, you know, I didn't even make them read it. You know, some guys would say, well, if he's not going to read it, I'm not going to do it. Ah, you know what? I'm going to read the book. I'm going to have a couple of quotes that I'm going to throw out there. I'm going to model for my sons what I want them to do. And man, we just had rich conversations that I so appreciate today because when they call, we have conversations about real stuff. And it is so much fun. Another thing that I think about that's maybe a little weird. So my first son is an infantry officer. Well, if he had to read a book at school about leadership, I would buy the book and read it so I could talk with him about it. My other son's a helicopter pilot. I just not too long ago read a book about helicopter pilots in Vietnam. So I learned some of the language and I could talk with him. My other son is in paper science engineering. I've read a whole book about paper. Who reads a book about paper? It's unusual, but I want to know what is going on in their world so I can speak to them and relate to them. And, you know, so you say, well, that's why do we do that? Well, you know what? I think Jesus modeled that. I mean, how often did he use real life examples and tangible analogies so that guys could relate to what's going on in life? He knew what was going on in the culture and in the times, and he wanted to relate to the people around him. And that's all I was doing as a dad, was seeking to relate to them so that we could have conversations about responsibility and leadership and integrity and honesty. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, son, I'd rather hear an uncomfortable truth than a comfortable lie. So tell me the truth no matter what. Even if it hurts you, if it hurts me, guys, I want to know the truth because you never have to back off the truth. And so we would just have conversations throughout life about what's going on right then. And that was part of the process of speaking man to man and keeping things in front of each other so that we can, so that I can encourage them in the journey toward manhood. Now, I may have kind of wandered off there, but that's part of what I think is so critical. So does that resonate with you and how you've done some things?
100%. And I'm not a great storyteller, but it reminds me of so it's a story I read and some of our audience have probably read it, but it's a story of a boy who comes to his dad and dad works long and hard to provide for the family. And so the boy asks at some point, you know, hasn't seen dad very much, you know, just like right before bed, and finally says, "Dad, how much do you make an hour?" And the dad's a bit bothered by it. And I don't remember the exact number. And dad says, $40 an hour.
Yeah.
And so the son says, "Dad, can I borrow? I've got $20. Can I borrow $20?" And dad's kind of frustrated. And he says, "I work really hard. Why do you need $20? Why do you need $40?" And the son says, "Because I want to buy an hour of your time."
Yeah.
And the story is just crushing.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it justice, but it's this revelation of what it means to a kid. And it reminds me of what you just, I'm spending time with my kids.
Right.
So I remember reading this. How do children spell love?
Yeah.
And the answer is T-I-M-E.
Right.
And you go, wait, what? What does that mean? Man, kids want to spend time with their parents.
Yeah.
Mom and dad.
Yeah.
But by the way, it's mom and dad. So if you're a single parent, it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's why God designed marriage to be one man, one woman for life.
Yeah.
Be fruitful, multiply, have children.
Yeah.
That's God's good design. So, man, we just have to be intentional with our time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your kids are a little older than mine. And I'm recognizing this window where my kids live in my home is closing quickly. And so, man, if I've ignored that opportunity for the past 17 years, I didn't do myself, I didn't do my kids any favors.
Right.
So you got to be intentional with your time.
You do. And what I would say, because there can be guys out there who are hearing this and saying, holy cow, I didn't do that. And I don't know what to do. And there's this Chinese proverb, you've probably heard it, that says the best time to have planted a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is now. So I would encourage you guys, and it may sound a little bit like I've kind of wandered off the beaten path here. We're talking about manhood, and I'm talking about spending time with my sons. But part of what I know about the challenge of helping young men find their way to manhood is they're looking for somebody to talk to. They're looking for someone to relate to. They're looking for an opportunity to ask the questions and not feel dumb when they don't know what to do. And, Dad, you are in the best position of anyone to be able to meet them in that moment. And so spending that time is so valuable. And so I would say, you know, if you realize, hey, I didn't start when they were 7 or 10 or whatever doing some of this stuff, well, start today. Start today. Buy a biscuit. Take your son out for a steak. Do something to engage him and start hearing where he is, who he thinks he is. Because we want to point them to Jesus. We want to point them to what Drew mentioned earlier is Jesus is a model of manhood, and we want to point them to him. But you can't do that in passing. You're going to have to engage that a little bit more deeply. And so I would just say start right now making strategic investments wherever you are in that process to help him on his journey to manhood. Because I think ultimately, you know, we'll go back to that original question is – becoming a man, is it a journey, a process, is one category, or is it an event? And I don't think there's one single event that makes us feel all of that, but there is the accumulating weight of responsibility and understanding of who we are that helps us have traction as men and begin to make decisions like men who see that the world is bigger than they are. Because I think when we're boys, we make decisions based on what's good for me. Mm-hmm. But part of being a man is making decisions that are good for someone beyond me and living the selfless life, which is, again, what we see modeled in Jesus Christ. So any final thoughts on this? Because I think we'll bring this one to a close, and then we'll chop up another topic.
Yeah, man. I appreciate the conversation. It's super fun. I just think we as a culture, I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians when I was a child, I talked like a child, thought like a child, reasoned like a child. But when I became man, I put childish things behind me.
Yeah.
I think as a culture, we've allowed childish things to perpetuate.
That's right.
And it's time for men to stand up and be men and stop doing childish things.
Yeah. Stop doing childish things. Boy, that's something we all need to remember. Because even at my stage of life, wrestling with all of this, I can still find myself being very self-centered, self-focused, and selfish in my relationships and the way I spend my time. And so that's a good reminder for all of us to live the life of manhood that is self-sacrificing and not childlike. Good stuff.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Drew.
Yeah, appreciate
your time.
Conversation.